From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, Lansing can't figure out how to fund road repairs, so voters in more counties and cities are taking matters into their own hands.
The kind of beauty is that you can see the result of your millage. You can see the trucks out there getting fixed. You can see the roads getting better.
How states are taxing the growing number of fracking operations. It can be a windfall and a political pitfall.
This is a frontline political issue. We've actually seen several gubernatorial races where this emerged as a very, very prominent consideration.
Telling stories of Native Americans moving from the reservations to the cities of the white world.
My mother always told me that she raised me to survive in the white world. She didn't want me to experience the negativity that comes from being a minority.
Oil and gas companies are drilling more, but states aren't charging as much as they could. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today on Stateside, what is stalling fossil fuel taxes? And then gathering the stories of Native Americans moving from reservations to cities. But first, now that Detroit is cleared to exit bankruptcy, its plan of adjustment approved by federal bankruptcy judge Stephen Rhodes, one of the most pressing questions is, how do you keep this from happening again? Enter the Financial Review Commission. The 9-member board met for the first time today. Michigan Radio Sarah Swick is here. Sarah, this commission was pretty critical to winning the state's share of dollars for the grand bargain. What is its task?
So this is a 9-member commission. It includes, it's headed by the state treasurer. The governor gets 5 appointees, and then the mayor of Detroit, Mike Duggan, and city council president Brenda Jones sit on it as well. And basically, they are there to make sure that Detroit is doing everything it's supposed to do as outlined in its plan of adjustment, which is the plan for how it's restructuring its debts in bankruptcy.
Do we have a sense of the kinds of people on this commission? Who were Snyder's appointees?
His appointees range from Stacy Fox, who is a sort of a longtime compatriot, I believe, of Kevin Orr, and she's also pretty well-known in Detroit circles, University of Michigan Law School alum. She's now serving as the chief counsel, I believe, for DuPont, but she had worked for Kevin Orr. And then several other people from drawing largely from the business community and several of its appointees, but also Tony Saunders, who served as the emergency manager briefly of Benton Harbor. So it's kind of a range of people, but leans toward the private sector.
How much actual authority will this board have, Sarah?
They have a pretty substantial amount of authority. So basically, they are tasked with making sure Detroit sticks to the plan that it has coming out of bankruptcy. And they make sure that it's sticking to that plan. It gets to review and approve all of the city's 4-year financial plans every year. It can approve all contracts, collective bargaining agreements. I think it remains to be seen exactly how involved they'll be at the micro level of things, but in theory, they have a very broad and specific number of powers.
And this is very much what happened in New York City that helped New York City get back to financial health. So it kind of seems like it's heading off on the bicycle, but with training wheels still on.
Yeah, I mean, I think New York was definitely used as a model here. In fact, Governor Snyder appointed Richard Ravitch, who was very integrally involved in that process, sort of as an advisor to this Detroit Financial Review Committee. But New York was under that control board, albeit more and more at a distance as years passed, for several decades. So this could be around for quite a while in Detroit.
Michigan Radio, Sarah Swick. Thank you so much, Sarah.
Thank you.
There are some programs in Michigan aimed at helping children living in poverty. Other programs try to help parents. Well, what about uniting these efforts, building a cohesive approach that tries to lift the entire family out of the cycle of poverty? That's the question at the core of the latest report from the Annie E. Casey Foundation. Jane Zender Merrill is with the Michigan League for Public Policy, the Kids Count Program. Welcome back to Stateside, Jane.
Thank you.
Give us a sense, what percentage of young families in Michigan are really struggling to pay the bills and put food on the table?
It's almost half. So it's a substantial segment of our children that are affected and families that are affected by lack of income.
And have the efforts to help kids and adults in poverty, would you say they've been too scattershot in Michigan?
I think they're not only sort of scattershot, they're very siloed in terms of work and training and education programs for parents. And then we have the child subsidy program for children, and we're building quality child care for children, but we're not integrating it. The best example of integrating the needs of parents and children is really Head Start, where parent leadership is encouraged. Parents are linked with opportunities to build on their soft skills, which are easily translatable into the world of work. And there's also sort of a wraparound of supports for families to make sure in those early stages of getting into training that they have what they need to be successful. Right now in Michigan, our child care subsidy cuts off at 120% of the poverty level, which is barely above poverty, and certainly not at an income level where you can absorb the cost of child care, which is substantial.
What would a more integrated approach to caring for these families in Michigan look like?
Well, one of the examples that the report cites is a home visiting program, where they've linked up the home visitor with jobs and training opportunities through Goodwill Industries. So that's one example of what can be done when you're working with a parent of a newborn who's also going to be looking for opportunities to work. And right now, when you look at the profile of the parents in low-income families, 80% of them lack a credential beyond high school. So clearly in this economy, to help more parents get access to college and post-secondary training is really an important strategy. But too often, those parents struggle, again, to get access to childcare so that they can attend classes.
Just like a hamster running in a cage, trying to get off that cage.
That's exactly right. I mean, and that's the other side of this, Cynthia, is that not only are low-income parents struggling to work and to be parents, but they're more likely to be in those jobs where they have no control over their schedule, nor is it predictable. So there's a lot of push at the national level to pass legislation around what so-called schedules that work, where workers would be given at least 2 weeks' notice of what their schedule will be. I mean, when you think about trying to care for young children, particularly, who often get sick, and trying to get them to the doctor for a checkup or even to arrange to take a class would be a significant challenge when you don't know what your work schedule is.
And you find out the night before that you have to be in at 8 the next morning.
Exactly.
Also, I found amongst the recommendations for Michigan interesting to let's look at financial aid for older adults.
Yes, very good point. We just looked at that issue and found that the state of Michigan has actually cut all forms of assistance for older adults returning to college. And that's another piece of this report. Our parents of young children, 85% of them are over the age of 25. So not only are they going to struggle to find childcare, but they're going to struggle to afford the cost of college
or training because there aren't programs there to help them return to school.
And Jane, what would be the effect of expanding the state earned income tax credit for these families?
It would be huge. We know, and in fact, there are research studies now that document that even a relatively small increase in a family income, a few thousand dollars, can make a tremendous impact on the outcomes for children later, particularly for young children who are very sensitive to the stress that their parents are experiencing while they struggle to work and meet the demands of being a parent. So by having that earned income tax credit at the federal level is great, but we can also supplement at the state level, which we are doing, but very minimally. We could do a lot better. And we also see that these parents are struggling with high housing costs. Almost two-thirds of these families are paying beyond what they should be for rent because their wages tend to be lower and the cost of shelter keeps going up.
Jane, do you have worries that the newly elected state legislature won't be willing to entertain any of these ideas?
Yes. I think, you know, the fact that we can't come to an agreement to support our actual physical infrastructure, like our roads, really causes concern among those of us who are concerned about our social infrastructure, the next generation. And when we're looking at these numbers and half of our young children are living in low-income families and their parents don't have a way out of poverty, I mean, the days have passed when you could start at a low-level job and work your way up to be president of the company. That's very unlikely to happen in these days. You have to have a credential of some kind in order to get access to a good-paying job. And without that, parents are really boxed in. So we really need to look at ways to create opportunities for parents and to better support children of parents who are working and parents who are trying to get that training or education.
The new report from the Annie E. Casey Foundation is titled Creating Opportunities for Families, a Two-Generation Approach, and we have been talking with Jane Zender Merrill with Kids Count in Michigan, with the Michigan League for Public Policy. Thank you so much for talking with us today, Jane.
Thank you, Cynthia.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The federal urban relocation project of the 1950s created one of the largest movements of Indians in American history. The idea? To lure Native Americans to big cities where jobs were supposedly plentiful. Its impact is being felt to this day. A new project's now being launched to collect the stories of the urban Native American experience in West Michigan. Let's learn more now as we say hello to Belinda Bardwell. She's with the Grand Valley State University Native American Advisory Board, and she's a member of the Little Traverse Bay Band of Odawa Indians. Welcome, Belinda.
Hi.
Good to have you with us. And Levi Rickert is here. He's an editor at Native News Online, also on the GVSU Advisory Board, and a member of the Prairie Band Potawatomi Nation. Hello, Levi.
Bonjour. Hello.
And both Levi and Belinda are project coordinators of this new program. Belinda, tell us the name of this effort. What is it called?
The name that we have given this project is Gi-Gi-Kino-Maw-Gaiman, and translated, that means we are all teachers. We hold our elders in high regard. They are our teachers. But for this project, we're hoping to get many people in the community to share their stories in the efforts to educate all of us and put us all in that teaching position.
I love the other part of the name, Defend Our History, Unlock Your Spirit, which I get a sense is that's the real mission of this, isn't it, Levi?
Yes, it is. And it's a very unique opportunity for Native people to come forward with their stories. And it's really about, you know, historically Native people have been storytellers, and albeit we are less than 1% of the population here in the state of Michigan and in Kent County and Grand Rapids, is, I think there's some really rich stories that are out there, and we just can't wait to get this project going.
I want to get some history and put this into perspective. It's the mid-20th century. Give us a sense of what was life like on the reservations leading up to and through World War II, because I'm wondering what gave the government the idea of coming up with this urban relocation idea.
Well, I think it was really an issue of trying to assimilate Native people. And I have said in writings and in speeches that the federal government really has never known what to do with American Indians. And as time progressed, you could argue they tried to kill us through genocide and with the Indian Wars and what have you. But as time went on, they realized there were still Native people out there. And what happened was, in order to assimilate us, try to have us become mainstream, if we want to say it that way, they said, let's move them to urban settings, move them to the cities. And that's what happened. And my grandfather and my grandmother, they came to Grand Rapids. And really, we were not taught our language. We got away from our tribal traditions, so to speak. But, go live in the city and everything will be okay. Well, and I think that was really the government's philosophy. And, we don't know if it worked or we don't. That's the nice thing about this project we're working on. We really want to find out what people think. Did it work? Did it not work? The reality is we are still here. And a lot of times that's a mission that we as Native people have, being less than 1% of the population, is to really solidify our existence. And a lot of times, we're like fell off the time pages after a wounded knee of the late 1800s. But that's not true. Natives are still here. We're vibrant. And I would argue there has been a major resurgence of Native culture in the last two or three decades. And I'm proud that we're part of this project.
And it sounds like, Belinda, that this project is in collecting the stories of this urban relocation. And you're trying to get a sense, was it bad? Was it an improvement? You don't really know yet, do you?
Well, that's the great thing about this project. It's very organic. We are in the planning stages, and we really don't know what exactly we're going to get, what people are going to share, what they want to share. What we're hoping to do is to create a collection of stories that can be carried for the next generations within our urban community, within our Native community, as well as, letting the non-Native community know as well as that we are still here. And to save those things for posterity, we are losing our elders, at a quick rate, those that are fluent speakers, those that have carried on those traditions. We need to keep those stories alive so that our next generation can learn from the past. I don't think we know where we're going if we don't know where we've been. And I think a big part of this project, again, as Levi said, is to let people know that we are still here. We still exist, and we're still very proud of who we are as a people, of who we are as American citizens, as well as our tribal citizens, that we are proud people.
Well, share a story. Belinda, tell us your family's story.
Well, my family is connected to the Burt Lake Band up in northern Michigan. As you mentioned, I'm a member of the Little Traverse Bay Bands of Odawa Indians. My mother was raised in Petoskey, suffered, the typical racist environment, and experiencing that when it came time for her to move out and graduate high school, she decided to move to Detroit for the job. She had a cousin and some friends that moved. They lived together and, joined the urban community there. And she actually did really well. She had, we come from strong grandparents, and she had a very strong mother and father with a great work ethic that she succeeded in Detroit. And then as she got older and her brothers and sisters then migrated out of the Petoskey area. They settled in Grand Rapids and Indiana and places like that. So upon visiting up north and coming home for the holidays, she met and married my father. They decided to raise me in the Grand Rapids area, just south of Grand Rapids in Wyoming, which is where I was raised. Every weekend we would go up north. We had a cottage up there. So I got to experience the local traditions and culture up there. However, I grew up and I didn't realize there was an Indian community in Grand Rapids. I knew I was Native. I knew my mother was Native. There was not really a Native community in Wyoming that I knew of. So there was always that feeling of being lost. And I don't want to come off as being negative, but it wasn't until I was in my 20s that I realized that there was a large Native population when I attended Grand Valley State University. And that's when I got that fire that, you know, started to burn in my heart to become connected once again with the Native community.
Levi, you shared with us that your grandparents were kind of caught in that sense of get to the city, get off the reservation. Was it because things were bad for them, or they just felt things could be better in the cities?
You know, my sense has been that my grandparents came to the Grand Rapids area so that for opportunities with education and employment, to a large degree, it worked. I mean, I have a sister, and we're really proud of her, Dr. Jessica Ricker. She's the first American Indian dentist ever. Second person in the United States who's Native to become a dentist. So when she graduated from the University of Michigan in 1975, so we're really proud of that. My grandfather, Levi White Pigeon, had a fourth grade education. So when you think about that, that's pretty pretty deep. So we're really proud of her, and we should be. You know, I've had the good and bad that happened to me, but overall, I can say that you know, I cherish the memories of my grandparents, Levi and Ellen White Pigeon, both Potawatomi people, wonderful people. And they taught us how to be Indian, and the respect for one another within families, the love that we share, and that has been very rich. But here it was in the urban setting. In my experience with reservations really happened after I started Native News. I actually, in 2011, visited some close to 30 Indian reservations throughout the United States, and I actually saw a different life that I was shocked in some cases where Native people live in third world living conditions in the United States. And that's why, going back to this project, it is important that we collect the materials, the information, the rich stories to find out really exactly what happened.
And when you think of this social experiment, whether it was the official urban relocation project while it ran, or else just people like your grandparents, Levi, who said, you know what, let's go to this city. When you look at the Census Bureau that says, you know, before World War II, only about 8% of Indians lived in cities, and now we're looking at 78% of Native Americans living in cities, and I have to wonder how this is affecting the reservations. Is it draining away the lifeblood?
Well, you know, Michigan, I think it's a little different, and we have seen a shift after the advent of casinos, whereas the casinos have allowed a revenue flow to come back into the reservation land, and the tribes are in the state of Michigan now able to provide services. And so in that regard, we have seen a migration from the cities. People graduate from, in our case, Grand Valley State University, and they get employed by tribes and, you know, some of the reservations around the state. So as a Native
person, it's a happier
person,
story than perhaps we've seen in some other states.
Well, that is true. That is true. Yeah. And it's always real, very subjective. But at the same time, I think that going back to this project, that's why this project is going to be, I think, full of rich stories. And we can't wait to be called back with an update and tell you what we found.
The project is We Are All Teachers, Defend Our History, Unlock Your Spirit. In fact, this project kicks off with a community gathering tomorrow evening from 6 to 8 at the Potawatomi Northern Health Center in downtown Grand Rapids. The public is invited to that, as well as to a campus dialogue next Wednesday the 19th from 6 to 8 p.m. at GVSU's Allendale campus. We've got details and links for you on the stateside page at michiganradio.org. Belinda and Levi, it has been an absolute pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much.
And thank you.
Chimagwech.
We've been speaking with Belinda Bardwell and Levi Rickert. Both are on the Grand Valley State University Native American Advisory Board and both coordinating this new project.
My failure. My failure. My divorce. My failure.
I felt totally bamboozled.
And I thought, this has to end. I can't do this anymore.
And now, a story of failure from Failure Lab Grand Rapids. Here's musician-songwriter Ralston Bowles.
Epic fail.
Failure to me is a band out of LA. Sounded like Nirvana, a little bit Soundgarden, I don't know, 70s kind of a period, I think, if you go back and look. But I don't think that's what they wanted me to talk about, that band. So then I started thinking about other aspects of failure to communicate, which was a movie quote that I saw, and the captain talking to Paul Newman, and I thought that was pretty cool, but I haven't failed. I've only found thousands of ways that things wouldn't work. At least that's what Benjamin Franklin or Thomas Edison or I think how many people have been told said that. So I grabbed that quote. I thought, well, maybe I could apply that to this as well. There are a lot of great quotes that I started looking for, and they all seem to apply. And I started writing these down because, after all, you got to come out with some cards and sound like you know what you're talking about. There's only one thing that makes a dream impossible to achieve, and that's the fear of failure. Ever tried, ever failed, no matter, try again, fail again, but just fail better. And we are all failures, at least the best of us are. And that was J.M. Barrie, who was Peter Pan. That was a great, great story about not wanting to grow up. And that was kind of my childhood. I really didn't want to grow up. I enjoyed being a kid because I saw, after all, how much failure filled the lives of all the adults around me. I felt when I didn't have anything that I needed to worry about, I didn't have any reason to fail. I could just look to the other people and they would sort of step in and fix things for me. I remember as a young child, about the age of 6, that my dad came home and holidays were not the greatest for me in that regard. He would come home rather inebriated and decide that he had a desire to communicate, which was a failure to communicate as far as my mother was concerned. And as a result, he would become very introverted and self-loathing and pull out a gun and decide he was going to off himself. And as a 6-year-old, I learned what it meant to be a crisis counselor in the front porch of my house. And that went on until I was about 14. And I wanted out of that situation. I wanted to come away to college. I wanted to make my mother proud of the male figure in her life. So I came away to college, and she had impressed upon me one of the ways that you get out of your situation is to get an education and do well and move forward and achieve, even though failure is the lesson that is the best teacher sometimes for us. We tend to not want to embrace that part of it. We want to cover it over. We don't want to fail. So for me, what I began to learn to do is for papers and things like that, I got to the deadline of a particular paper in college, and I borrowed very heavily on other authors to finish this paper. And I thought, you know, a good paraphrase was as good as as a footnote. And so turning that paper in, I was quite proud of the fact that I was able to knit together all these wonderful viewpoints and authors into what was apparently a cohesive piece of beautiful literature from my pen. And at least from my perspective, I thought it stood the ranks of any scholarly works that had been released, especially since most of them were included in this particular piece. And much to my chagrin, upon meeting the professor who was teaching this course, he also seemed to know most of these authors as having had them in college and was taught by them and probably was more aware of their works than I was. Even with my beautiful polishing and rearranging of their terms, the basic skeletal structure stood that I had a paper that was not mine. And as a result, he said to me, I cannot pass you in this class, this course. I had done so well in school leading up to that point. I had pretty much it all in my pocket. But this particular person, this particular professor said, you know what? You fail because you did not meet the expectations of your own self. You borrowed heavily, and all you would have had to done was provide me with your viewpoints, whatever and however meager they were. But I'm sorry, son, you get an F.
Counties, cities, villages, townships, they've all decided if there's not going to be money coming from above, they just need to raise it themselves. They need to ask their taxpayers that these are the roads that they're going to drive on the most, and if they appreciate the poor level of repair on those roads, that it's time to cough up some money and let's get it done.
How many counties actually had road millages on their ballots last week?
It was just a couple last week. And if you go back to August, both elections had about 20% of the questions that were road millages. Some were – a lot of them were levied by townships, many cities, and a couple counties. So at this point, most of our counties have a road millage one way or another. A lot of the cities are either levying a dedicated millage or, of course, they're taking general fund money to do that, pay for that as well. And the townships, they don't have direct control of the roads, so they're just raising the money and asking the county road commissions, come in and do it for us. We need these roads fixed.
What's the batting average? You know, put the millage question out there for voters to decide. How likely is it voters will say yes?
With road millages, we're seeing about 80% success rate. It has a high level of success. The kind of beauty is that you can see the result of your millage. You can see the trucks out there getting fixed. You can see the roads getting better. Sometimes when you have a millage, you're paying for something that you appreciate having, but you don't see directly. So you're hoping your money is being spent wisely. With road millages, millage today, work tomorrow, better roads down the road.
Yeah, and as we've often heard people say on this program, it's you're going to pay one way or the other. You're going to pay in a millage. You're going to pay perhaps if they wind up with gasoline taxes, or you're going to pay with a blown rim or a bent this or that. But I wonder what message you think Lansing lawmakers should take from what they're seeing happening at the local level.
Well, it's two messages, really. One is that the voters are ready. They're willing to pay more. The roads need to get fixed. They understand public services don't happen without tax dollars, and they're willing to do that. But, you know, I see there's a good side to this as well. What we do at the Citizens Research Council is promote good government. And one of the principles of good government that we promote is that the people spending the money should be responsible for the taxing of it. If you use it more wisely, if you had to actually go to the voters to ask for it. So in a way, this is a good thing that the local governments are not waiting for money from above, waiting for manna to fall from heaven. And here's
for Big Daddy to shake the money tree.
Right. Here's the money. Go spend it. They have to go out and actually tell the voters, we need that money and we'll be accountable for how it's being spent. So, yes, it would be good. We need the Lansing to do something to get money. Lansing, of course, is the most efficient way to raise the money, to have gas tax or registration fees. We don't need the competition from unit to unit to one has a gas tax and the other one doesn't or something like that. It's better if Lansing does it. But it's good local governments have skin in the game too.
And what are the things that the local governments are using that money for? Give me an idea of how it's being spent.
It's mostly fixing the roads. We're not building new roads. We're not putting concrete where it hasn't been before. They're either paving over roads that have been there, they're patching them, they're tearing them apart and reconstructing them. It's trying to make the roads well so, again, that we don't end up in the bump shop fixing a tire, fixing a bumper, fixing whatever.
Yeah.
Let's make the roads passable so that we can live our lives.
And is some of that also getting ready for the upcoming winter? Because I know we've talked, for example, to the fellow in Washtenaw County whose job it is to acquire salt.
Right.
Prices are up and they're worried about another bad winter. Is some of that going to prepare us for winter as well?
Yeah, absolutely. Isn't as a road engineer, whether you're at the city, the state, or the county level, you have this balancing act of fixing the roads, of roadside and, you know, beautification, making sure the grass is cut, things like that, and also making sure there's enough money put aside, hopefully not for a winter like we had last year, knock on wood. But they know, you know, we live in Michigan. It's going to snow. The roads got to get cleared. We need to have salt for the roads. We can't do like a lot of other states, just throwing sand out or dirt to create friction. That we need salt to melt our snow. So that's costly. And as salt prices go up, it becomes more costly.
Well, as you point out, saying yes to your township or your county's request means you will see those orange cones go up, but at least you know you're getting something for your money.
Yeah, it's good. It's results, direct results, and something we can hold our government officials accountable for.
Eric Lufer, president of the Citizens Research Council. Thanks so much, Eric.
Thanks for having me.
Good to see you. Thanks for inviting me.
Describe for us the ways that states have at their disposal to tax fossil fuels.
This is a little different than what we tend to think of with energy taxation, a gasoline excise tax when you pay at the pump or tax that might be added onto your electricity bill. In this case, I was working with Rachel Hampton from the University of Michigan Law School, looking at what are called severance taxes. What happens when you take a non-renewable natural resource like oil or gas from below the surface of the ground and then remove that for some kind of use? Not going to be replaced. The oil and gas industry in the U.S. is well established. This really began well in the 19th century in places like Pennsylvania and Ohio. So a number of states historically deep in oil and gas have had these kinds of taxes for a long time, certainly Texas. What is beginning to happen, though, as we begin to move into the shale or fracking era, is that some states that were thought they were getting out of the oil and gas business are getting back in a big way. Or other places that don't even have much of a history of this at all are jumping in big time. And in some cases, dealing with all the regulatory and other questions that emerge with fracking, but then also looking at these taxes, what they should be, how they should be set. And then if you have a bounty, what do you do with the money?
So these, in many instances, are states that we will use the term newbies at all of this. They're not old pros like Texas.
Enter North Dakota. It wasn't that long ago that Rand McNally was thinking of dropping North Dakota out of the atlas. There was not going to be a North Dakota map because it was thought to be so inconsequential. North Dakota is booming. A number of the counties in the U.S. that have the highest rate of per capita income are now in North Dakota. That's all because of oil. And with it has come a bounty to state government. There are two severance taxes in play for the extraction of oil that were set up many, many decades ago. Mm-hmm. And this year it's expected that about 65% of the entire North Dakota budget is going to come from these energy taxes. With it, at the same time, there are lots of strains in North Dakota. The unemployment rate is low, but there are lots of strains, infrastructure and other kinds of things related to fracking. And so a big issue in politics in that state is, again, how do we use these revenues? How do we use this bounty? Do we think about near-term considerations or longer-term? But it also pops up in the pioneer states, places like Alaska and Texas, but also beginning to come up in other areas as well, including some in the Midwest.
What about in Michigan? What's our situation?
The situation in Michigan is that fracking is still a fairly limited activity. There is some oil and gas production. There has been for a long time. Usually Michigan is ranked somewhere between 10th and 20th in terms of the largest gas and oil producers in the country. And there's been a lot of discussion even in southeastern Michigan of expanded activity. That said, that seems to be slowing somewhat in part because of the decline, the dramatic decline in pricing because there's so much supply at this point. So no one is really thinking that Michigan is going to be the next Texas or North Dakota or Pennsylvania. And yet about 0.5% of the Michigan budget this year will come from Michigan's version of a severance tax, which has been in place for a long time. It addresses each amount of oil or gas as it's being removed. Most of that money goes into general revenues, a very small amount, and then a tiny portion of that is put into something called an orphan well fund, which is to manage or close down abandoned well operations. And you can drive in many places in the state and find historic oil and gas operations.
You kind of point out in your study, it's impossible to really do direct comparisons of state severance taxes to say, well, are we making the most of it compared to our neighboring state? Why is that?
Clearly, a severance tax works alongside a whole number of other taxes, corporate taxes. And of course, Michigan has just been through huge reform in that area, taxes on small businesses, other kinds of sales taxes, property taxes. Each state presents a separate mix of questions in terms of taxation and the like. Clearly, though, we think one of the reasons why a number of states have set fairly high taxes historically, and frankly, states we tend to think of as right of center and conservative states, tend to have consistently the highest tax rates. These tend to be fairly popular, unlike gasoline taxes, which we may be talking about again soon in Michigan.
Road funding debate. Absolutely.
But in the case of severance taxes, most of the oil and gas that most states produced is consumed elsewhere. So if you're talking about Alaska, which has the highest tax rates in the country, Alaska only uses 1% of the oil that it produces. Texas, only 7%. So there's a chance actually to export some of those costs and then impose a price via a tax on the oil and gas as it's being extracted, again, never to return.
Tax away. It's not going to be passed on to our people because they're not using that.
That's
the idea.
Right.
But what about if you are in an area where there are shale deposits underground that run across to a neighboring state, so there's some competition?
The plot thickens.
Mm-hmm.
This is where we move into questions of local governments and how they engage in regulation, or even in some case so-called shale plays, deposits that don't honor state borders or boundaries.
No one told shale when those deposits were being made where the state boundary was going to be.
Absolutely. No jurisdictional boundary follows a shale play.
No.
So there's not only the process of hydraulic fracturing, but there's also the horizontal drilling component, which means you can cut across. Now, in most cases, most of the drilling is going to take place within a township or within a county or certainly within a state. But we are beginning to see issues where this begins to emerge. And then an especially interesting question in a great many states that are reaping in a lot of this revenue is, who gets that money and how do you return it? Do you return it to those local governments where the fracking is being done? Do you simply put it into general revenues, as we do in Michigan, as Texas does, as most other states do, and just blend that in with general revenues or a school trust fund or something like that? Do you link it to very special purposes where there could be environmental damage produced by fracking and apply that? So in state capitals really around the country, again, not so much yet in Lansing, but around the country, this is a frontline political issue. We've actually seen several gubernatorial races where this emerged as a very, very prominent consideration.
Do states that have the possibility of a good amount of severance tax revenue, would they barter down and maybe soften the taxes in order to say, all right, you're going to bring jobs here and kind of do some horse trading with these energy companies?
This becomes a real possibility, especially when you move from an era not that long ago where we talked about peak oil and the end of oil and gas production or the inevitable decline, where producers and states, for that matter, thought perhaps they could set the taxes as high as they wanted to because there would be so much need for that energy. As the supply increases, states clearly, we found, have become much more cautious in how they create these new taxes, how they set their rates, and come up with all kinds of provisions, not only to keep the tax rates constant or relatively low, but provide all kinds of exemptions and credits to get people into the market, to get them into drilling operations. So we've not seen the kind of aggressive increase in taxation that we saw earlier. And again, politically, in some cases, making for sort of political fallout. Alaska has just gone through a really, really tough battle over the governorship, which actually still hasn't been settled.
Right.
A ballot proposition, all fought out over how these taxes should be set and how the money should be used.
What does Michigan need to learn from what you've discovered in this study?
Michigan has an opportunity here because the fracking process is moving so slowly. And that gives Michigan, presumably, the chance to learn from the experience of other states. This is a policy arena where, unless we're talking about drilling on federally held lands, it's largely a state or a state and local responsibility for setting the rules of the game, taxation, and everything else. And so we're seeing states on taxation and everything else moving in a number of different directions on this. I think one of the very interesting pieces that's beginning to emerge on this is coming from places like North Dakota, where they are having this bounty, but they are also mindful that when you have boom economies related to energy, there's often that bust. Some even call this a resource curse. Pennsylvania's been through this, other states as well. Michigan experienced this after we did the first cut of timber and had to deal with the aftermath of all of that. Well, North Dakota has dusted off an idea that was in play in a number of Western states in the 1970s, but that is to create a trust fund, not a rainy day fund, but a trust fund. It's a lot more than just a bank account that you can raid. So for all of the revenues that are coming into Bismarck, 30% off the top are taken and put into a trust fund, almost like a lockbox, that the legislature cannot touch until at least 2017. And they're going to take the next several years to think about investment strategies, how to develop that, and perhaps develop a longer term of revenue, both to deal with some of the long-term environmental challenges that might emerge over the coming years in North Dakota where there's extensive drilling, but also deal with that inevitable bust. The only state east of the Mississippi that's begun to move in this direction is West Virginia, which also has a tremendous history of boom and bust. We've not seen that in places like Michigan or Ohio, but there are some real opportunities, I think, to learn from other experiences what to do and what not to do if this is going to go forward.
That whole trust fund idea to a civilian seems eminently sensible. Is the political will, does that become a real political hot potato as far as can they keep their mitts off that money?
Well, it's eminently sensible perhaps in a longer term, but the short-term politics of this can be difficult. I think one of the most interesting places to be politically in the United States, believe it or not, in the first months of 2015 is Bismarck, North Dakota, where the legislature, which only meets a few months every 2 years, it's a part-time legislature, is actually going to be looking at all aspects of this. And I anticipate a long line outside the Bismarck Capitol with groups saying, trust fund is fine, but show me the money now. If you're a local community and your population has doubled or tripled, you have road issues, you have infrastructure issues, the state caps what you can levy on property taxes, you might have public health issues, you have housing questions. In North Dakota, just to use that example, all over the western part of the state, which is shale intensive, the states are saying, fine with the trust fund, but get us more money now. That issue is going to play out and is playing out in state after state. It's already coming up in places like Texas and Pennsylvania. We're beginning to see this on our southern border in Ohio. So that's really one to watch and think about that. So again, the initial appeal of a trust fund sounds great. But politically, do you really want to take the risks of putting all that money into a trust? Well, again, we have history of this in the Alaska case where there are dividends on royalties, which are different than the taxes. And a number of the Nordic countries, most notably Norway, uses a trust fund to fund much of its social welfare state.
It is interesting and clearly well worth Lansing policymakers keeping a close eye on what's done elsewhere, because we know, as you say, we're in the early stages of it here in Michigan, but it's coming.
It's coming.
Barry Rabe, always a pleasure to talk with you, Director of the University of Michigan Center for Local, State, and Urban Policy.
Thank you.